The effect does work. We've all seen it by now, probably in the cinema. I think the question is whether we want to take that into the home, invest in a whole new TV set, invest in the glasses, when there'll be very limited content at first, anyway.
I suppose Rising Damp reruns will never be the same again. But you did say that you saw an internet-enabled car. What is that?
That was quite extraordinary. I've just been sitting in the seat there. Ford have brought out a car with a whole bunch of touch screens. So as well as the normal controls and navigation and music, you can turn the car into an internet hotspot. And they're stressing that's mainly for the passengers in the back to be able to surf the internet while you're driving along. But you are able to synchronize the car with your phone. And they said to me that if I wanted to update my Twitter status, I couldn't actually do that, but I could listen to tweets coming in via the microblogging service by uttering voice commands. We didn't quite get that up and running, and I was slightly frightened by the prospect of that, I have to say.
But yeah, exactly. Don't you get the feeling that some of these things are a bit over the top? I mean, tweeting while driving, or what is it?
There's always an element of over the top at this show. It is Las Vegas, after all. What do you expect? But what will happen is some of these trends will definitely end up in our living rooms quite soon. Others will end up basically in the dustbin of gadget history. A lot of it is there just to create a bit of a buzz. But there are real developments happening, particularly in the computing world. This whole idea of a device which is somewhere between a phone and a full laptop computer, which might be giving you books to read, movies to watch, music to listen to. It does seem to have a lot of weight behind it now.
All right, Rory, we've got to run. Have fun. Technology fair there in Las Vegas.
I've got to buy a new TV, new Blu-ray, new glasses, new 3D DVD.
I still got the black and white.
BBC.
It is not only kicking the ball as such, but we are doing politics with it.
With the first World Cup to be held in Africa approaching, the BBC's Farai Mangazi tells the story of African football.
There can be few places where a sport has taken on more national and cultural significance.
Africa Kicks. Online from the 8th of January at bbcworldservice.com.
The BBC investigates whether Somalia's vicious civil war is spilling over into neighbouring Kenya. Assignment on the war next door at bbcworldservice.com.
This is the BBC in Beijing. Kampala.
Reykjavik. Delhi.
Wherever you are, you're with the BBC.
You're listening to KPFT, Houston 90.1 FM.
Welcome to World Briefing from the BBC World Service with Jackie Leonard at midnight GMT. President Obama announces how he's to improve security after the attempted Christmas Day airliner bombing.
We will not succumb to a siege mentality that sacrifices the open society because great and proud nations don't hunker down and hide behind walls of suspicion and mistrust.
The United Nations says a video showing Tamil prisoners of war being summarily killed in Sri Lanka is genuine.
There was nothing to indicate that the video was a fake.
The Argentine president orders the removal from office of the head of the country's central bank and an emotional arrival in the Caribbean for the first quadriplegic sailor to complete a solo voyage across the Atlantic.
25 years ago, I broke my neck and it put me in the wheelchair. So it's held dream to sail back across the Atlantic.
Of a recent article, The Demise of the Death Penalty in the U.S. The execution watch begins.
to see from her perspective. By the way, how many folks you got out there with you, Gloria? It's very cold there.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, about 8 of us.
Well, considering the weather, I think that's a pretty good showing.
It is. Unfortunately, a couple of the people that usually come were sick, and it's freezing. In fact, when Elizabeth first called me, I didn't answer the phone because my fingers weren't working. I was not punching the right buttons on my cell phone. It's freezing, yeah.
It's freezing over there. Well, let me tell the audience that the witnesses have crossed the street. That means they go from one building into the walled unit itself where the death chamber is located. But there were no family witnesses today, apparently, because they would have crossed shortly thereafter.
Right.
And so we are presuming that the execution process has begun and will continue until completion. And, Gloria, you'll let Elizabeth know as soon as something happens.
Yeah, I will. It looks like the cops are gathered in a circle. I think it's kind of hard to see, but I guess somebody's speaking up at the other end of the block. And it was in the news this morning that the Garland police force had chartered a bus for the officers and their spouses to come up here. And, you know, I got a very interesting email after I posted that. I'm like, you know, holy cow. They're bringing a busload. And plus, there's supposed to be a car caravan coming. And after I posted that on the Abolition Movement's email list, I got a reply from Joanne.
Yeah.
She said, well, how appropriate, because that's what people used to do in the South. They're carrying on a Southern tradition of when a lynching happened, you take the wife and the kids and you go watch, celebrate.
Okay.
And I thought that was an interesting observation.
Well, of course, Joanne has always given interesting celebration.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. Let Elizabeth know when something happens, please.
Okay, I will.
Okay.
All right, bye-bye.
And that was Gloria Ruback, and you can get in touch or keep up with Gloria Ruback by going to www.abolitionmovement.com or abolitionmovementweekly.com. So that is the news wing of their organization, their website. That was Gloria Ruback. She's regular on Houston's KPFT's prison show. And thank you. And so now we've got a chief engineer came in and pushed the right button, so all of a sudden my ears came alive. And it just takes a miracle worker that knows which button to work. Mm-hmm. By the way, we wouldn't be able to do any of this if it weren't for Otis McClay. He is our wizard. We're waiting for a connection to Brian Evans in Washington, D.C. In the meantime, I have with me in the studio a genuine Richard Vogel. And Richard Vogel, tell us, how did you get involved in these death penalty issues anyway? You seem like a nice academic sort, maybe a teacher even. How did this come on your radar?
Well, Ray, first I'd like to say thank you for having me down on the show here. And how I got involved in this is, it seems to me that we're all involved in it in different ways. I was a graduate student at the University of Houston in 1972 when we thought that the death penalty was dead. When the Supreme Court, Furman decision, the Supreme Court came down, I was a sociology student, and I read Thurgood Marshall's analysis, his sociology and his criminology that he had consulted making his decision, and then I read his eloquent statement about announcing the end of the death penalty. And as a graduate student, I thought, wow, we're making some serious progress here. And that chapter's over. And of course, then I went on to do different things. I had to start working, and I started teaching public school, and then we had the death penalty back with a vengeance.
Richard, I'm going to suspend it at this point. We're going to get back to this conversation, but we now have on the phone from Washington, D.C., we have Brian Evans. Brian, can you hear me? Nope, I've lost him. We lost him. Richard, we have to go back. She's got to go reconnect.
So as a I wasn't an academic. I was teaching public high school. But the thing that happened with the restitution of the death penalty is this happened in the South. This did not happen in the United States. For the period before the Furman decision, 61% of the executions used to take place in the South, which, of course, was disproportionate to begin with. But in the period after the death penalty was reinstated in the South, starting in the 70s and the 80s, that has moved to 81% of all executions have been in the South. So, you know, all of us that live in the South are right in the middle of, you know, what I call, you know, death penalty central here in Texas, in the death penalty state. I've always viewed it as a primarily a political issue. And, of course, the question then came up was, what were the politics that were restoring the death penalty after we thought it had been replaced? And that's what I've been tracking, and that's what I try to analyze in The Demise of the Death Penalty, that I recently published on my website, and it's been passed around a lot. The main thing that you find out when you start looking at the details is the states that picked up the execution. Of course, Texas is the main one. But all of these massive numbers of executions took place when the neoconservatives became governors in the southern states. In a way, you have to, it's almost as if, you ready to switch?
Yeah, we're good.
Okay, good.
Hello, Mr. Evans.
Hello, how are you doing?
I am well. Brian Evans, tell us where you are, Brian, and what you do.
I'm in Washington, D.C. I am the campaigner for the Death Penalty Abolition Campaign at Amnesty International USA.
Okay. Are you at all familiar with the case before us tonight?
Yeah, so we issued an urgent action on this case back at the end of November, so I'm somewhat familiar with it.
Tell us about it.
Well, you know, in some ways it's a typical Texas case. It's a case where someone is going to their death without the jury ever hearing very important evidence. In this case, evidence that Mr. Mosley was mentally impaired. This evidence, basically because of his exposure to pesticide as a child, this important mitigating evidence was never presented to the jury. When lawyers presented it to the appeals courts, as usual in Texas, they kind of yawned and just sort of rubber-stamped the execution. So, as is all too typical in Texas, we have a case going to execution without a jury ever hearing important evidence that he may not have deserved the death penalty.
Well, this case was set for execution earlier. I remember we were preparing to do a show about it, and then he got a stay late in the process.
Correct.
And we were able to cancel that show. Has there been significant legal examination of this case?
He had a petition with the U.S. Supreme Court at the time, and they didn't want Texas to execute him before they considered the petition. So they stayed that execution, but then they declined to hear the petition. So it just went back, and Texas rescheduled. So there hasn't been anything significant.
So there were no new hearings, no new trials, no evidence presented that had not previously been considered?
No.
In execution business, is this a norm for you?
Yes, as I said, in cases like this, we see it all over the country where if you have a lawyer who doesn't present everything in the kitchen sink, in your trial and in your sentencing phase in terms of mitigating evidence, if you don't get it out then during the appeals process, the appeals courts are very inclined to look the other way and just keep the process moving forward to execution, particularly in Texas. And that's what happened here. There's plenty of evidence that Mr. Mosley had serious mental impairment, as well as some evidence that the shooting was accidental. But particularly the mitigating evidence, if the jury had heard that, it's quite likely that a jury would not have issued a death sentence because of the strong evidence of mental impairment.
Well, I'm not very good on geography, but is Garland, Texas, actually in Tarrant County?
Oh, I don't know.
Okay.
Not very good on geography either.
In Texas geography. It is in Tarrant County. We get a lot of these cases from Tarrant County, and there seems to be a lot of consistency in the insufficiency of evidence we get out of Tarrant County. I don't know what's going on with the judiciary and the prosecutor up there, but there seems to be a hesitance at looking in depth at cases that go through their venue.
Well, I think that may be true nationwide, that appeals courts, particularly federal appeals courts, state appeals courts, like in Texas, where the judges are elected, there's often a disincentive to interfere with a conviction. And federal appeals courts, there are a lot of layers of rules now that prevent them from taking a really hard look. So a lot of cases sort of slip by, even though, you know, there's a lot of evidence that didn't get introduced, because the appeals process is just not that strong for political reasons and for sort of bureaucratic reasons that have been set up in the last 10 years.
Well, I mean, in your work with the moratorium project, how there's a lot of people talking about the evidence of some progressive forward change. For instance, the statistics of capital cases, even in Texas, in terms of courtroom convictions, are down significantly this year below last. What is your reading of that?
Death sentences are down very significantly. At the end of the 1990s, there were more than 300 death sentences a year in this country. Last year, there were barely 100. Texas had less than 10. I think it was 9, which is lower than in three decades. We won't see the results of that for another 10 or 12 years because of the long time between death sentence and execution. What we're seeing now are executions for people who were sentenced to death in the late 90s when death sentences were at their height. So it's likely because death sentences have declined over the last 10 years that over the next 10 years we'll see a decline in executions, maybe a significant one.
Do you have any comment to say to people who argue that we wait too long to execute and that's not necessary? What about those figures in comparison to actual innocence findings?
Well, I certainly don't agree that we wait too long. I don't think we should ever execute anybody. But certainly we need to get it right. And even with all, you know, the appeals, we've still had cases like Cameron Willingham where it seems pretty clear that an innocent person was still executed. There have been 139 people exonerated from death rows in the United States, including 11 from Texas in the last three decades. That's a very large number of people where a very large number of mistakes were made. So you have to get it right. So there's no argument to be made that time should matter at all.
Well, those numbers are very persuasive, for instance, in Ohio, weren't they?
Oh, in Ohio?
Where the governor suspended all execution.
Well, he did briefly. and he was sort of, you know, just preempting the courts. Executions in Ohio are definitely back on. They had one this morning, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
And they have an execution scheduled every one per month all the way through June. So Ohio is actually going to be, after Texas, probably the highest executor in the country.
Mercy. Well, there was another item in the news today that came out of the Texas Attorney General has ruled that it is possible for a governor to pardon someone after they have died on death row. In a case of actual innocence, the governor had previously refused to do that, saying that he couldn't under the law. And Abbott today issued a statement that Mr. Cole could be posthumously pardoned for his crime.
Well, that's good news. I know that that's happened in, I think, in South Carolina recently. There was a case of a posthumous pardon. I think it happened in Georgia as well. So it would be good for Texas to do that.
Okay, so do you have any other comments about tonight's execution?
Well, in addition to Mosley's execution, which is, you know, an all-too-typical travesty of justice in Texas, there, as I said, there was an execution in Ohio, and there's an execution in Louisiana going on as well of Gerald Bordelon, who has volunteered to be executed. It's a very bad day for the death penalty, but as we discussed, the long-term outlook is still good. 10 years from now, we'll be talking about a lot fewer executions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Evans. We're talking to Brian Evans, who is with Amnesty International. He's a campaigner for the Death Penalty Abolition Campaign. More information about that work can be found at amnestyinternationalusa.org, Texas Moratorium Network. Okay?
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
And that was Brian Evans. And now we're back in the studio. It's amnestyusa.org. Okay, amnestyusa.org. So we're back with Richard. There are other calls we expect to come in. We expect to hear from Gloria in Huntsville. Charlie Doyle is standing by in El Paso. And they're having a vigil in El Paso. Most of the vigils around the state have been suspended because of the inclement weather. Gloria and a brave almost 8 or 10 souls are outside the walls in Huntsville, where it's even more significantly cold than it is in Houston. And we congratulate their heartiness in the process. Richard, I keep interrupting you to do these other things, but that's not unusual on Execution Watch. We just kind of have to piecemeal. You and I are going to have a longer time to talk in a few minutes. Do you want to pick up where you left off and move a little forward?
Yeah, not a problem, Ray. I understand the way a program like this has to be put together. I would like to try to put a longer range view on this, and just as added dimension to the discussion that we're having here, I had just made the point that after the restitution of the death penalty, more of the executions were done in the South. And this was the when we get a chance to talk about this, Ray, we're going to talk about the political context that took place in.
Okay, we have Gloria. Gloria? Gloria? Nope, I don't have Gloria. Gloria?
Yeah, hi, Ray.
Okay, what's the word there?
Well, Kenneth Mosley is dead. The cops are still down at the hill, down the street, taking pictures of God knows what.
They're taking pictures of one another. I was there when Kenneth Mosley was lynched, and that's what that's about. Now, they probably need a little help. If someone could go down and tell them where the donut shop is, they might break up a little quicker, because the cold, even in a police uniform with a jacket, it's cold out tonight.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I've got on long johns and layers and a down jacket, and I'm frozen.
All right. Gloria? I don't know if we got a disconnect or it was one of those button things, and that can happen on cell phones. I'm going to take up with Richard. Give us a little run here, and then we'll get in touch with El Paso. Go ahead, Richard.
Okay, again, trying to look at the political context of the restoration of the death penalty. I looked at all the states and tried to break down where the majority of the executions were taking place. When the death penalty was being reinstated, there was a lot of connection between the southern states, and California was a contributor to it, and also the federal government, to try to get the death penalty back as quick as possible. And I think an important question for us to ask, we think about the individual tragedies and all the lives that have been lost, and of course this was the same time that mass incarceration was being carried out in the United States and all the prisons were being built. And we were entering into a very repressive era. The United States the federal government was passing funding laws to get the death penalty facilitated. Judges were being given courses on how to persuade juries to give the death penalty. And in this context of the political right wing swing that was taking place in the 80s and in the 90s. My biggest concern at this point is that people who are against the death penalty start looking at the death penalty not as a single issue, but in the political context. Because if it simply falls into disuse and the state can reserve their right to execute people, we have not won this contest. We can only win this contest when the death penalty is outlawed for political reasons. Of course, the implications of that, we all have to think about the implications of it, foreign policy implications. You know, if the United States and the states forego the right to take human life, then we have to look at foreign policy, and the body count in foreign policy is certainly higher, all you have to do is read the newspaper, than it is the death penalty. And, you know, it's not some kind of conspiracy theory. This is America, the way it operates.
It's arithmetic.
It's arithmetic, but it's the suppression of internal colonies and the empire in the world. And there's a connection between them. And it's my thing is, let's face that. And as citizens, let's try to come to terms with it. You know, it's not cost effective. We know that it costs a lot of money to execute somebody. It also costs a lot of money to have, 3 million people in prison. But it's not basically a question of money. It's basically a question of the political direction of the United States and the political purposes of the state. And, we need to catch up with the world, not because it's bad press not to catch up with the world, but for the sake of all the citizens in the United States and the sake of all the citizens outside the United States that get the same kind of treatment.
What do you think? Do you think people are oblivious to these issues, or that people have considered and rejected these issues?
I don't think that people are oblivious to the issues. You want to transition?
Yeah, we've got a caller from El Paso. Hello?
Hello?
Charlie?
Yes, speaking.
This is Ray Hill in Houston. Tell us, what about your vigil out there?
Yeah, it's going to begin at 6 o'clock.
It's going to begin at 6 o'clock. You are...
We have to do it at that time because people don't get home from work.
Sure, I understand. You understand that Mr. Mosley has been executed.
Yes.
And so Gloria, who was in Huntsville tonight in a very cold night, bundled up, and there were a whole bunch of police officers there from Garland, Texas, taking pictures of one another.
Ready to shot.
Taking pictures of one another in celebration that they were there for the lynching.
And so
I suggested that someone slip down and give them some inside information of where the donut shops were in Huntsville, and they'd go speeding off right to have some warm coffee. Why do you do this?
Why do we do it?
Yes.
Because we think it's the right and proper thing to do, because we do not believe in the death penalty. We don't think it resolves anything, and we don't think it brings closure.
Characteristic.
Do it because we're praying for the victims. We're praying for the offenders themselves and their families, both groups of families. And we're praying for an end to violence in our community, all right, in our nation, and in the world.
And where do most of the folks that come from? Are they from churches and local?
It's mostly from the church. A lot from here, from this particular church, St. Patrick's, but we have people from other churches come too.
Okay, and do you have the support of your bishop?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay. Houston recently got our first cardinal, and one of his first actions was to go to Huntsville and join a vigil outside the death chamber.
That's wonderful, really. Yeah.
And we hadn't seen anyone there in a crimson robe in a while, but he went to that area. And when the Pope was in Texas, he mentioned the importance of the issue to the church.
And
I appreciate you folks in El Paso holding forth. El Paso seems almost like another place. You're in a different time zone, and you are closer to Los Angeles than you are to Houston out there.
Yeah, well, I like to say to people, we're the 23rd largest city in the country, so we're not, some rural area.
And there's a lot of violence in your area, perhaps, more across the border.
Not in El Paso. El Paso, just recently, it was in the USA newspapers, the second safest city in the country.
Uh-huh.
Of the large metropolis, all right? All the trouble is over in Juarez.
Well, we appreciate you folks having a safe place to live.
Yeah.
And thank you very much for your vigil. Elizabeth is going to be calling you again.
Okay.
Okay, and your organization and group is what?
We are the Criminal Justice Ministry, all right, in the diocese here of El Paso. And we are affiliated with the El Pasoans Against the Death Penalty, And the El Paso ones against the death penalty are affiliated with the Texas Coalition against the death penalty.
Okay, okay. This is local folks down here, Texas Coalition Against Death Penalty. That is the website, tcadp.org.
Right.
And I appreciate having you with us. Give our love and regards to the other vigilants when they get there this evening.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, appreciate it.
Bye-bye. Well, Richard, does listening to these folks scattered around the state concerned about the issue give you any hope?
Well, it's always good to hear, and we want people to stick with it. I know after I wrote this article that I did about the demise of the death penalty, I got a lot of feedback from people that were saying, you know, thanks for updating this, and thanks for giving us a new look at it and a political look at it. Ray, you had asked me just before we switched speakers there a minute ago, what did I think that people, how's the public at large viewing this issue and how are they reacting to it? Well, number one, you know, there's been all these calls by legislatures. The legislators always try to co-opt what the people are thinking. I don't think they think for themselves. They want to get a step ahead. And of course, one of them is the pushing these bills for life without parole instead of the death penalty. And they're getting the feedback from prosecuting attorneys all over the state, and they're saying, we can't get this. You know, we can't get convictions. And they don't like to lose. They're all building careers, and they don't like to lose. So they're talking about they're hoping they can get a conviction on life in prison without parole. But the faith in the death penalty is being eroded. I think one of the watershed events was when Governor Ryan of Illinois just emptied death row. They had so many people from the Innocent Project that were obviously innocent. He's just before he left office, he said, you know, I'm just going to commute everybody's away from the death penalty because it doesn't work. Interestingly enough, I think that a lot of things are converging at this time. The American Law Institute has now abandoned their argument trying to justify the death penalty on any kind of intellectual basis. And it's interesting, their comments sounded exactly like what Thurgood Marshall said back in 1972. And Thurgood Marshall said, it's overwhelming. There's overwhelming evidence of racial, gender, and social class discrimination in the administration of the death penalty. When the death penalty was reinstated, all of those problems were supposed to be solved with these formula that the American Law Institute came up and told the states that, you know, we can write laws that can do away with it. So now the American Law Institute has thrown up their hands and saying basically what Thurgood Marshall knew and what Thurgood Marshall had spent his whole life fighting, which is what came up in the Furman decision. So we're kind of back to 1972, you know, maybe progressive politics can pick up where it was interrupted at the time by this neocon rush to control the states and control the world, and we can get back on course on establishing, number one, human rights. The death penalty is not a financial issue. The death penalty, to me, is not a moral issue because it's a moral issue in the sense that it's a human right. You know, no state has the right to kill. In 2007, the United Nations passed a moratorium for all member nations. It said nobody will be executed anymore under any circumstances for any purposes. And the United States did not sign into this. This is like 2007. History is catching up with the United States very quickly on this issue, I think, Ray.
Well, in the 1990s, we had a change of administration. We went from Republicans in the 80s and the early 90s to we went then to Democrats. We had Bill Clinton. Things didn't change much as far as criminal justice and executions were concerned. We didn't get much progress in the 1990s. It wasn't until very recently when the states began offering juries an alternative to execution by the slow form of execution, which is life without possibility of parole, that we began to get changes.
You're absolutely right, Ray. It was Clinton who signed the Effective Death Penalty Act, the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act. But when you look at the broad spectrum, he's also the guy that signed NAFTA, that shipped all the jobs overseas. He's also the guy that signed the anti-welfare legislation that kicked everybody off of welfare, which was the first step of getting him kicked into prison. He also signed the legislation that cut down Health and Human Services. So then we had all of the mentally disturbed people that ended up in the state prisons. And, you know, so we need to look at the death penalty in the context of social policy and how it interacts with all the other social policies. There is no doubt, and I think that most Americans know this, there's not a lot of change whether it's an R person in there or a D person in there. We've seen that with Obama. So it's the citizens themselves, it's us that have to sit down and make the demands and say, well, wait a minute, you know, like, no, it can't be business as usual, because look what business as usual for the government has produced us in the prison issue and in the death penalty issue.
In your website, you've mentioned it several times. We're fixing to ask you to give it to us. Do you discuss the interconnectedness of all these issues?
Absolutely. I did a lot of research on an issue that nobody wants to touch. And I'd like to, you know, if you think we can bring it up on the prison show one day. And it's and I have an article, and it's called Globalization and the Incarceration of the Black Working Class. And it tracks exactly how the laws and the war on drugs were structured in order to lock up masses of people in the inner city. The Republican Contract with America proposed a Taking Back Our Streets Act. This was in 1994. Who was on the streets that was bothering everybody? It was the marginalized people in the inner cities. Okay, they delivered, you know, the Republicans deliver. They say, we're going to lock them all up, and here's how we're going to do it. And that's what they did, and they made a Democratic president sign the legislation that did it. As citizens, we need to take serious stock.
Well, this seemed very familiar. In the last few days, I've seen something on the internet about some commentary about the effect on voting patterns by incarceration. Well, there was a decision some northern Midwestern state that said that, as a matter of fact, the denial of vote to people incarcerated is, in effect, watering down or diminishing the ability of black people to elect representation. Are you familiar with that decision?
Yes, I am.
What is it?
We need to look at the fact and recognize the fact that 40% of the executions in modern times have been black Americans, okay? It's down a little bit from before the moratorium that took place in the 1960s. Before Furman. But they're still the major customers, okay? And the incarceration rates, again, are people from the inner cities who were taken out, a lot of blacks. We have a population, if the prisons, we can't afford the prisons anymore. States are drying up. Their revenues are drying up. Today, Schwarzenegger said, we can't spend this money on prisons anymore. We're going to let people out of prison. We now are going to be facing a situation where we have masses of men whose life has been ruined by 20 or 30 years in prison, coming out into the streets, have never seen a computer, have never seen a wireless device, in a time of economic downturn. If you turn them loose, what's supposed to happen? What do we think's going to happen?
Well, in Texas, we know what's going to happen. 70% of them is going to return to prison on the next possible bus.
Except the numbers. The way I read the numbers, there's no way those numbers can be accommodated in prison again, because the Texas prison system had scheduled a 15% increase in beds per year through 20. What was the report? Okay. That can't be done. And it was an underestimate. So, you know, we're looking at crisis. We're looking at social crisis and political crisis around this issue, bigger than anything we've seen in the past, Ray.
Well, recently, Texas has tried some experimental stuff, and a lot of that includes alcohol and drug addiction treatment in prisons. You know, I've visited those units. I've had a look at those programs. They at least seem to be working at the time, and we've actually been able to divert, according to a Dallas Morning News editorial today, some 1,800 people from returning to prison. But 1,800 people is not a very big number in a prison system of 140,000.
Correct. Absolutely correct. And those numbers can't go any way but up. And the new clients for prisons are going to not be the inner cities anymore, because if you look around at any of the inner cities, you'll see that most of them are condos, you know, that's all being gentrified. It's going to be citizens from the suburbs. The children of citizens from the suburbs are going to be the candidates this time, and a lot of them are going to be whites and other minorities. So the configuration of the prison people talk about their clients. You know, I actually, when I was back doing graduate work, I went to a couple of their conferences, and they talk about their clientele. Okay, the shifting clientele is going to be a massive clientele. Again, it's going to be the drug war is going to be used, because people, especially young people who feel helpless, and I'm sure you've had a lot of experience with this, turn to drugs with their alternative activities that they've got. So either the United States and Texas are going to try to look at what's causing, like, the massive drug abuse or people turning to drugs. Of course, that turns you back to the economy. And, you know, what are we going to do about that? Chances are there will not be another war on drugs that's going to put that many people back. So there's the crisis. That's what are we going to do with these people? And then, you know, it ties us back to Clinton and signing NAFTA and all the jobs that went south of the border and the jobs that went with globalization. That's my major concern on my website.
And you discuss this interrelated issues on your website. What is your website?
It is Combating Globalization. You can just Google Combating Globalization. It comes up, because I don't have any competition for that.
CombatingGlobalization.com.
Okay. And it says, you know, I'm concerned with monitoring the effects of neoliberal globalization on working people in our communities. I'm not an anti-globalist. You know, I like coffee.
Yeah.
And, you know, we
don't grow a lot of that,
that's
except
right,
in Louisiana.
You know? And so fair trade globalization is possible, okay? Free trade globalization, neoliberal globalization, is killing all the working people on both sides of the fence. And we have to look at the interconnectedness, and we have to look at it realistically. We have to do our homework. And you know, as I've told you in conversation, we can't be single-issue people anymore. We have to go ahead and look at the relationship between incarceration rates and execution policies and the state of the economy and
immigration.
Absolutely. That's one of the biggest issues that we have to face down here. And that one stalled down. We were having a conversation about that.
Is your website interactive? Can folks feedback to you?
Absolutely. I have a blog on there, and I have it set up where we can start strings of discussions on different topics. I've been up long enough now. I'm starting to get a lot of international opinions on it. There's people who want to talk about immigration. I need some help. I need some writers. I have some people I'm willing to put up. I have a submissions policy, and I have already put up several very interesting articles. And I'm trying to establish a place where we, the citizens, can go ahead and talk about these interconnection of these things and not try to get it from the newspaper, because you're not going to get it, and it's just not there. And explore these things and have some input in them, because, you know, I don't want to reinvent the wheel. That's not my job. But there is absolutely no discussion of the interconnectedness of the issues that we're facing taking place in the mainstream media right now, Ray.
You're true. Journalism in the old sense is kind of dead. Journalist vehicles are falling like sparrows in today's weather in Houston. But the thing about it is, I frequently ask this question on the show: are you optimistic or pessimistic about the future?
Number one, I've never felt that I knew enough to answer that question. You know, I've been down and out myself. I came from a working class background. My father went bust so many times I can't even remember it. We never owned a home when I was growing up. You know, I'm one of the baby boomer generations, lived through the golden years of the United States. And the golden years are coming to an end. We're going to have to face some serious decisions and some, you know, there's some adjustments that are going to have to be made. And how we do them is going to be our test as citizens. But at the same time, you know, there's no way we can accept being cynical. You know, Ray, you and I are a little bit dusty and a little bit, you know, thread-borne, you know, I was kind of noticing. But we have a lot of young people now that are coming out. They have dreams. They need opportunity. You know, one generation can't sit back and say, well, we got ours and we're doing okay and we're pretty cynical about the way the world's going to turn out. That's totally unacceptable.
No, as a matter of fact, of course, one generation yields to a following generation. But in terms of complex thinking and complex analysis of interrelated and complex issues, someone has got to start teaching and training and recruiting and motivating people to actually do that kind of thinking. Do you see any ways to do that?
Actually, I think that it's going to happen. Citizen journalists are going to take over, and themed websites are going to be shaping a lot of opinions. All right, even kids that are going through school, and I've talked to kids at universities. I go out to U of H every once in a while and talk to the kids out there. They don't think that they're getting what they need from the university. Of course, the University of Houston has become a corporate university like all the other centers of higher learning, so to speak. And so, you know, we have a possibility of talking to everybody that's carrying a laptop or a netbook or a smartphone. You know, so we need to get our act together and talk to them in a very realistic way. It's very experimental. It could fail, but I'm not cynical about it.
Well, by the same token, universities are getting packaged. Media is getting packaged. Of course, media is also proliferating. You literally can live in a media world of your own choosing. For instance, KPFT is now four radio stations housed in one building. Because of the digital effect of digitalization on broadcast media. And television stations are multiple stations at each channel site. And what's going on beyond that is the Internet is providing another vehicle. I mean, my God, if you can get a telephone for $17 a year, the way the wavelengths have been split up, you can get damn near anything anywhere. So you can live in a media world completely of your choosing, but doesn't that do something to broad-based analysis of the society and its problems?
The other side of that, Ray, is I have a webmaster who's a technical genius, and he just volunteered. He read some of my stuff, and he said, I'll give you whatever you want. I'll be your webmaster 24/7. Let me take my technical knowledge and see what it can do. The other side of what you're saying, Ray, is I can go on the Internet and I can go to a site that's called Google Analytics.
Mm-hmm.
And on Google Analytics, every country that somebody has checked into my website, you know, that country lights up.
Mm-hmm.
And you can actually sit there and watch it happen sometimes. Now, at first I was kind of skeptical about this because, you know, I'm kind of old school and wasn't ready for this. But I said, okay, if I got these, you know, resources at my discretion, you know, I should use them. And so the first thing that happened was I had a bounce rate. People would get on this website and they would say, oh, my gosh, or whatever. And they'd bounce out in 7 seconds. That's bad, okay? Now, my webmaster, very interesting guy, he said, you're doing something wrong, because if people bounce out like that, you need some more bells and whistles. So we tried some bells and whistles. Okay, it didn't do any good, right? And then we found something very interesting, and that is People bounce out quickly, but they come back. You can't know who's on your website.
Yeah.
But you can know if people come back. So we have people who bounced out in 7 seconds the first time, and on their second trip, 2 weeks later, are spending 9 to 13 minutes in there.
Okay.
That means they are reading these articles and they're reading them in depth.
Well, what I get is a condensation. I get all this condensed in a weekly report on my website, The Prison Show, and by virtue of that, I can see who links from The Prison Show to Execution Watch. So I have some sense of who's listening to this program, and they come from 8 or 9 different nations. And they seem to have a pattern of repeat listening. I mean, the folks in Sweden listen to this every week. And the folks in England listen to this and The Prison Show because of the amount of time they're staying on gives me a hint of what that's going on.
Right.
And so we can now know who is in their audience and who is out there and who is reaching in. And I'll get a report in the morning for this week and be able to analyze it up until showtime tomorrow. But the point I want to make at is that may be well and good, but you understand that if these are political issues, and you insist they are.
I do.
If these are political issues, politics is a numbers game. So that means somebody's going to have to be motivated enough to go out there and reach out and find other people to coalesce with to make political change happen for the positive in this regard. How does that happen?
It is happening, and we need to learn to listen and watch how it's happening, Ray. Okay, first off, I would like to say we need to have a quality product that we offer on our websites if we expect people to come back. Some of my favorite people are some wobblies, some young people in Toronto.
Yeah.
Okay, and they
now
pick...
my audience may not know who wobblies are,
okay.
But if you were old enough to go to the anti-war movement, I traveled across this country with lots of wonderful old wobblies.
These are young wobblies, international workers of the world. They've joined. They got a website that's kind of interesting, okay, and they're kind of anarchist, but they do cool stuff, you know. Like for instance, they organized Starbucks. You know, Starbucks was. You know, Starbucks is Starbucks. You know, everybody's part-time work. Everybody works on a sliding pay scale. You know, it's McDonald's. It's the refined,
McDonald's
genteel
with
McDonald's.
Caffeine.
Absolutely, right. And so these guys got together, these young men and women, and I met them, and they're enthusiastic. They're crazy. They carry their tweeters with them and their cell phones, and they do flash mobs. They do what's called flash mobs, and the government is afraid of flash mobs because we've seen them in Iran and we've seen them in some other places. The wobblies in Toronto can get 150 people at a Starbucks
in an hour. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, the future of virtual political organizing is open. You know,
yeah.
We don't even know if it can be done. We're not even sure what it is we're saying when we say that. But you watch these kids, and the kids in Toronto did it. And, I mean, the oldest one there is like 26. The old man of this group is like 26 years old. Okay? So we Ray, you and I can't do, you know, step back and say, well, we're going to turn it over to these new kids. Right? Because we need to learn from them. And they can learn from us if we deliver what we're supposed to deliver. It's kind of like, you know, how can that not work? It's like the only thing that can work. And so, you know, not having 50 lawyers look over our shoulders and telling us what we can say and not say, the freedom of the internet, we have got to learn how to maximize it. Soft power is going to run the world. Hard power is almost over. And we need to learn what soft power is and how to create it.
And that voice is Richard Bogle. And Richard has been with me most of this hour. I've interrupted him several times to bring in other reports. Our bottom line tonight is Richard Bogle, or Kenneth Bogle, is dead. At 51 years, Kenneth Mobley. Mosley is dead. At 51 years old, he was convicted of a 1997 killing in Garland, Texas. The police were there to celebrate his execution, as was our own Gloria Ruback, who kept us informed of what was happening as it was happening. And that is the nature of Execution Watch. We try to cover it as live and as close to the source as possible. Charlie Doyle is just now gathering a group of people in El Paso, Texas, as they gather to have a vigil tonight about Kenneth Mosley's execution. We were visited for a while by Brian Evans from Washington, D.C., who joined us to tell us about Texas Moratorium Network and a campaigner for Amnesty International USA's death penalty abolition campaign. More about him at amnestyusa.org. We have got to give special thanks to Nancy Bailey, who helped Elizabeth put all this together, Kristen Hoyle, and Dave Atwood, all here of Houston, who are supporting our efforts here by helping Elizabeth do that. Of course, we need to say thanks to Elizabeth Stein, our executive producer, and she can be communicated with at steinea@yahoo.com. Our technical director is the wizard, Otis McClay, who can be reached at omaclay at gmail.com. Theme music is from Victoria Panetti, and she can be reached on a MySpace page, MySpace.com/SheMonster. My name is Ray Hill. You can reach me every Friday night on The Prison Show, and you can find my website at theprisonshow.org, from which there is a link to the archive of executionwatch.org. Execution Watch is a joint effort created by Elizabeth and I to come on the air and bring you news of an execution in Texas as they occur. Absent tonight and Miss Sorley is none other than our own Jim Skelton. Jim, if you're listening, we love and miss you. Hope you stay warm and dry in this awful weather, and we'll get back together fortunately very soon. The next execution scheduled is on January the 12th, just about a week away. It is Gary James Johnson. And so those of you who have friends on death row, be sure and send your regards to Gary James through your friends. And Execution Watch will be broadcast that evening beginning at 6 o'clock. Details at executionwatch.org. My name is Ray Hill. I'm sorry we had to do this program, but I thank you for listening.